Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello, my name is Karen and I call myself the Chief Excitement Officer of my company Cryo Slices. I will be your host for this punchy, pragmatic and inspiring series called Risk, where we aim to reframe risk through a kingdom lens. I am so excited about hosting this series because the topic impacts everyone in a career or business. And having been an entrepreneur for over 25 years, spanning the entire supply chain from research and development in the medi and aesthetics technology space, right through to global exports and raising capital at various stages, I too have had to face risk on multiple occasions. Our guest today is Emmanuel Trinity, who has the most inspiring story that started in the slums in Kosovo and has turned into the significant impact of thousands of young lives. Emmanuel is no stranger to risk, and we look forward to gleaning from his experience and wisdom. Welcome, Emmanuel. You have an incredible story. I would love you to tell the listeners a bit more about yourself and where you come from and why you started Era 92 Creative.
Wow, thank you so much for that introduction. Yes, it's a pleasure to be here and, you know, have this conversation with you. I'll start with a disclaimer that many people think that Kosovo is in is in Yugoslavia, but I grew up in Africa. So I'm gonna go into a little bit of my story. But yeah, the beginning wasn't easy for sure. I was born to a single mom. My mom was abused at the age of 17. And when she got pregnant, my dad denied the pregnancy. But also her parents were very, very hard on her. And they told her, "We will not allow you to raise a child that doesn't have a father in this house." So my mom was kicked out of her home. And she was stuck in the middle at the age of 17. So what she had to do, she had to leave the village to go to the city where she thought she would find a better life. And that's when she got a culture shock that in the city, everything had to be paid for. In the village, that time they used to grow food and have their own small farms. First of all, she didn't have rent. She didn't have a house. So she slept under the tree for 3 months when I was just about 2 months as a baby. And through that, my mom got to learn about a community called Kosovo. So Kosovo was one of the worst slums in Kampala because it was named after the Kosovo of Yugoslavia because of the similarities and the injustice, the crime, the killings that was happening in this community. But unfortunately, that's where my mom could afford a house for only $2 a month. And that got her house and she moved into the slum. And little did she know that she was really getting us into more trouble than where we came from. Growing up in the slums, many kids in that state never went to the school. There was a lot of prostitution, killings. They had about 120 shrines with over 60 gangs of young people roaming around fighting. And so the injustices that was happening in that slum, it was very, very impossible to raise a child in a normal way. And so what my mom did to protect me, she made sure that she goes to work with me in the slums, you know, that she couldn't leave me behind. But she couldn't do that forever. So at the age of 9, 8, my mom got a job that required her to leave outside the slums and go work in the city as a waitress. So now she had to leave me behind. And that's when everything changed. Now, I didn't have a protection. I wasn't in school. And then I was exposed to what the gangs and the crimes in the slums could afford. And so that's what happened. One day, my mom came back home and she couldn't find me. At the age of 9, I was recruited to be part of B13, which was one of the notorious gangs in the slums. They offered us so many promises that there will be protection, there will be food every day, and maybe they'll take us to school. But I was a lie. So I accepted and I ran away with this gang. So between the age of 9 and 13, my mom didn't see me anywhere. I was recruited with 6 of my friends. And within 6 months, four of my friends got killed. And that's when I got a wake-up call that, yes, I might be the next one to lose my life. That didn't sit well with me, and I was praying to get out of this gang's life, but there was no way out. So you couldn't quit the gang. You couldn't just say, I'm out of this, because they would come after you. So we were stuck, me and my friends, in this gang for 4 years. And unfortunately, the day we got rescued was also a very unfortunate death, because when we went to steal and loot, and it was New Year's Eve, our gang leader got caught up and he was stoned to death. And we froze watching him die. And the lady who was there and said, hey, young boys, if you want to protect and survive, you should take off, run. We had her and we ran off. And that's the time something clicked in our mind and say, why don't we just run to this church for rescue? And that's what we did. So we ran and hid under a trench that was close to the community church that I just opened up in the slums. And we were praying for the better options out of life. And we didn't know Jesus, we didn't know anything, but we knew that there was something better than what we had in the slums. And so coming out, we went under the ditch for about 2 days, hiding. We thought that the community is still looking for us to kill us. And that's when a miracle happened in our lives. And this time, a group of missionaries had come from Northern Ireland, and they had come to build a school for street children in the slums. And this particular time, the morning we got rescued, they were actually visiting the community to see the injustices, to see why they need to build a school in this community. We were lucky that our local pastor who had built that church knew about us, and he saw us and said, hey guys, these are the boys that we really want to help in this community. And that was a lucky moment. So they reached out to us and they gave us some first aid. My friend who had fainted, they helped him out, gain his breath again. One of the ladies that was part of this group was so much interested in our lives. And she was, boys, I want to help you, but I want to know, what's one thing that I can give you that will never go back on the streets? And I'd never been asked such a question in my life. And I told her, I knew what I wanted. I say, for me, if you give me a computer, I'll never go back on the streets. But I knew why I wanted a computer. I wanted a computer to play some games and all that stuff, you know. So this lady say, you know, if that's what you want and you promise me that you'll never be back on the streets in the gangs, we are going to give that to you. And my friend who was also rescued asked for a guitar because he wanted to become an artist and a musician. And so they told us, if you promise that you can come to this crusade that is happening tonight, we are going to give you what you need. And that's what happened. And so we said, if these guys are true and they've already given us new clothes, we should do something. So we branded ourselves the Happy Boys and went to this crusade. I got my computer. And even more on that, when they called out young people or people who wanted to get saved, we were one of the very first ones. And so I gave my life to Christ at the age of 13, went off the streets and started my journey of transformation. It wasn't an easy one. This church showed us love and they really supported us through that journey. So with this computer, yes, I played games, but I started doing something with it. I started learning graphic designing, tutorials, you know, video editing. And actually, there was a place to practice those things. I started the media department at the church. I recruited 25, 30 young boys off the streets to join me in the church. It was great. And between the age of 13 and the age of 19, I worked so hard and became one of the best graphic designers. I'd really practiced the craft, but my life was still struggling to put food on the table. My mom was still poor. My mom was still fighting for her life every day, working odd jobs. So our lives economically hadn't improved, but so much spiritually, we had a huge transformation. And so I didn't know what to do with that issue. But one day, we were always looking out for an opportunity to get out of the slums, an opportunity to get on the other side of town, not into the slums, where it was flooding, chaotic. And lucky, Coca-Cola used to organize these talent guntus, where they wanted to pick up, you know, talent from the slums and pick up these smart, brilliant, creative, artistic, talented people from the slums. So this event was happening every December. every person in the slums across Uganda, they were preparing for this to get a breakthrough. And it was very competitive. People are really talented. And that showed me how much talent was in these concentrated slums. Brilliant young people. And so the first 2 years, I didn't make it. But when I was 19, we got a very, very lucky moment that me and my friend that were actually both rescued off the streets, we both got a breakthrough through this. So he got signed up by biggest record label in Uganda. And I was recruited to be a junior designer at Coca-Cola with a paid internship of about $300. And that for me was like, many people couldn't believe it. And just the next week, I was working in a corporate environment. I was working in an air-conditioned environment. Life was just drastically changed in just a period of 1 week. I was like, how could this be possible? There are just two worlds, one with run by scarcity and limited opportunities, and then a world where everything is possible, you're working, you can be able to take care of your family. Yeah? And when I stepped into that, I immediately got this burden that why most of my friends are not going to be able to achieve this in their lifetime. They're going to be born in the slums, give birth in the slums, and their children will grow up and they'll get old in the slum and die in the slum. Why would that be and are still a thing when they are brilliant and they have the capacity to contribute to the society like I'm doing? Yeah, when this became like a very strong burden, I was reading the Bible and I was asking myself, what am I really going to do about this? And that's when actually I got this confirmation about my life and what I need to do. And this was the Bible verse, 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 10. And it goes, as each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. And for me, that was a very, very big moment because this verse just right there kicked into my heart. I'm like, God has given me all these gifts. He has rescued me. He has given me countless chances to survive from these, you know, deadly gangs. And I'm still here. But all these gifts that I have right now, it was just direct that I need to use them to serve other people in my community. And as you can imagine, as a young boy believing in God, I started getting now these crazy ideas, quitting my work, going back to the slums. When I mentioned this to my mom, when I mentioned this to my friends, like, I think voodoo is working on you. Witchcraft is still working in this community. How can you go and then come back? It didn't make sense to nobody. And by that time, I really trusted God for my life because before, when I was on the streets, he proved to me that he could protect me. And this is the time also that I had to trust him again. And so I took the risk and quit my job after 6 months with no clear plan. And I went back to the slums and I rented this house close to my community. And I said, God, I'm here to serve you. I'm here to use my gifts, but you lead me. And so that's right there. I went to the church the first week I quit my job and it was an overnight Friday. And I didn't know what to do. And so standing by, meeting a few friends at the church, I came across this girl called Megan. And this girl was leaning against the pole and she was really sad, but I knew her. But when she saw me, she smiled and said, hey, Trinity, good to see you and stuff like that. But after just saying hi to her for just 2 minutes, she broke down and started crying. I didn't know why. And then I told her, could you please share what's going on? And then she told me, I'm about to do something that I don't want to do and I don't wish to do. But because of my circumstance, I feel like this is what I'm going to do. So this girl was about to go in and become a prostitute that night because her parents, who her dad, who was taking care of 6 siblings, fell off the building and broke his spinal cord. So Megan was stuck in this middle and it really brought to me the idea that this is the moment many young people in the slums get to do crazy things because they don't have any other option. And that's right there started my work in the slums. And I told Megan, I'm not going to allow you to do that, but I've come back to community to start a program to help young people. So please, I'll support you. I gave her some money from my savings and I invited her to bring 2 of her friends and I also bring mine. And so with 4 people, I started Era 92 program to train young people in the slums with the hopes. I didn't know what to do with them, but I said, if I train them in what I know and they get good at it, I'll find them opportunities. Megan became one of the best website developers. Within 4 months, like, she really worked so hard day and night, and she was able to design a website in Drupal and WordPress. And for me, that was like the moment I saw this make sense, and God confirmed my mission and say, let's do it again. And so I realized that we had planted a seed and it germinated, and now we have to plant it a million times. And to date, we've worked with over, 9,000 young people. We've created over 3,000 skill jobs for young people living out in the slums, connecting them to local and global opportunities. We have over 120 employees working full-time to make this work possible across 4 communities in Uganda. We have 6 social businesses that are generating income and providing jobs for our friends and young people in the slums. And the money that is coming from that is reinvested back into scaling our work into other communities and slum areas. And so, yeah, that's pretty much the journey where God brought us from this chaotic environment to turning us into servants for his kingdom.
Oh, Emmanuel, that is very inspiring. And I think there's lots to dig into that I'm sure our listeners are probably burning with some of the questions that we are, because it seems so counterintuitive to go from where you were, where you could possibly just have kept increasing and going, almost backwards.
Yeah, I think, yeah, you say the word backwards. That's what everyone told me, like, yes, you can't go back and then take 100 steps back. I realized that what I was doing, enhancing my life, wasn't involving so many other people. And so I wasn't being a good steward of what God has called me. And so for me, that was like, for anyone who's like that, is like, if what I'm doing is not impacting the lives of other people, then I'm doing it for myself. But the Bible was really clear for me that as good stewards of God's very grace, as each has received a gift, use it to serve one another. When I looked in my life and where God has brought me up from, there were so many evident steps that there was God in my life and God had already worked. And it was easy for me to trust him on this one, because there was, before, there was nothing to lose. Here, this time, there was much to lose, but he had already proved to me that you have our back.
Emmanuel, your definition of stewardship is very inspiring and challenging and convicting, I think, for most of us listening. Because in the business world, we often see giving out of an overflow. We say, okay, we're going to help others, we're going to give, we're going to tithe, start NPOs once we're successful and once we have an overflow. Your journey shows that the kingdom of God is counterintuitive, because you had only just started on that journey of success. You were hardly out of the starting blocks. Yes, you were comfortable and you had huge doors open to you and you could have just kept going. But already at that young age and stage of your life, you understood that we don't give out of the overflow. We give out of surrender.
Sacrifice, yes. Yeah, that's so true. I think there was, for me, a big learning from Jesus Christ himself. We want to live like Jesus, but sometimes it's not easy to live like Jesus did. He had to leave his comfort of heaven and calm down and die for the restoration that we needed between our lives and the relationship we had with God. He had to die. He had to come and live on this earth to live that pain and die. And for me, what really taught me, like, wherever there is redemption or restoration, there's going to be sacrifice. And as redemptive entrepreneurs, there is that dying to self that has to happen for us to see others win. That for me was the logic behind everything, is that I don't have to first get $1 billion or you $1 million for me to be able to do this work. And also the realization that if this is God's will, it's God's bill. But so many times we are doing out of our own energy and power to make these things work.
That is so true. And I'm hoping that there's lots of startup entrepreneurs listening to this podcast, many of whom may be in your situation to a degree, with perhaps very little. I know I started my business that way with absolutely nothing, a canoe and a mandate from God to trust him for the resources. And there were zero resources. And you just have to take that leap, I guess. But it's not easy. And it looks like you started with exactly what you had in your hands. You took this leap of faith. You went back to the slums. You rented a little shack or something. And there was Megan. All of a sudden, you bump into the first person. God gave you the first person to start training and skilling up.
Amen. From there, people started to come and, you know, just do work for us. You know, after that, there's a friend of mine who came from Canada and said, Trinity, I want to spend 6 months with you just improving your program. Another one came and said, I want to help you build your business model and stuff like that. And help started coming like that. I mean, I don't see that typical intervention in you know, normal businesses. You know, there was a grace that God brought into this mission because it was utterly for his kingdom.
Very inspiring. You also mentioned earlier on, you started unpacking the multiple social enterprises under the Era 92 group umbrella. And you spoke about the thousands of young people that have been impacted, that have been skilled, that have good jobs now, been impacted for the kingdom. There's obviously structures in place. There's obviously some good decision making and some good business principles tied in there and wisdom. Could you talk to us a little bit about those business models, how you manage that, how you manage risk within those layers and levels? That would be great.
Thank you. God helped us to come up with this idea. When we started out, honestly, I didn't have a good experience with nonprofits. And I also didn't have a network. I didn't have like a lot of funding friends. I was just a kid in the slums. So that really led me to think about how can we be resourceful in our context that I'm not going to be looking out for external funding and stuff like that. And so we built a model, first of all, that requires us to use income to generate jobs and sustain our work. And then we build a model that utilizes a philanthropy to expand our work. So if someone comes today and they want to support our work, that helps us to go into another community, but not to sustain our work. And then we use capital impact investing to actually increase our loan lending capital to start up another business and stuff like that. So we have that three-tier model in terms of the funding space on how we run our work to make it sustainable. And so we had to build a model that holistically improves and changes the story of these young people. We use that tagline that we partner with young people to change their story. And we are not helping them, you know. We are not like coming out in the slums to help kids and stuff like that. That's not our language. We realize that if you're going to impact someone's life, they're going to do more of the hard work than us. For me, I've just come and give you 1 year of training. You're going to be doing that for years and years of your life. So we changed our wording and say we are here to partner with young people to change their story. And the model is simple. We take them through a one-month discipleship and mentorship program where we try to change their mindset about, you know, everything that they believe. You know, so many limiting beliefs for people coming out in those underserved communities. And right after that, we expose them to what is possible. You know that light at the end of the tunnel. So many kids in the slum don't have that light lighting for them. It's complete, total darkness. And so we try to paint, this is what your life could be. This is what God has in store for you. You know, God has plans for your life, and we are here to work with you to realize those God-given gifts. And then from there, we give them options. That's the skilling part. The skilling part is where we are training them for 7 months to 8 months into real life-changing skill sets that are on demand with the current employers. And then after that, we go to the placement phase where we place them into these places of work locally and internationally. And how that works is that we place these young people into companies that we call employment partners for a paid internship, as it happened in my life. I thought that if someone is working for that, even if it's, you know, small $200 for a start, it's able to help them show that this thing is going to work for me. And then we don't limit them to skill sets. We know we have brilliant young entrepreneurs. So recently, 2 years ago, we launched the finance part where we finance these young people to start their own small businesses. So we run a 6-month incubator and redemptive business program where we help them to understand the concept of not to be a social entrepreneur. That's easy to be a social entrepreneur, but to become redemptive entrepreneurs. And with that, now we have now 6 businesses. We have a portfolio A. Portfolio A is where we have Era 92 Creative, Era 92 Elevate, and Era 92 Fund. And so those are the companies that are running. Elevate is a school. Creative is an outsourcing business that is connecting these young people to global employment opportunities. And Era 92 Fund is a microfinance bank that is funding these young entrepreneurs. And we have Portfolio B of our businesses. Portfolio B, these are businesses that are helping us create cash flows. So we have a car wash, 2 car washes, we have restaurants, we have a safaris business, we have tours and travel. So these are businesses that immediately put our young people to work as interns, as they are getting real life experience, and they're also making us revenue to sustain our work. And then we have Portfolio C. Portfolio C, this is where we have businesses that we have invested in for these young people. So these are not our own 100% businesses, but they're businesses that we've incubated. So they're under our portfolio and we've invested in these young people. And so in total, it's about 10 businesses so far under all the Portfolio A, Portfolio B, Portfolio C. But it's turned out to be a working model that has created these life-changing opportunities for young people.
Emmanuel, I'm very inspired by your outsourcing model that you touched on. I've been in a number of conversations and webinars where we've talked about what Africa's offering to the world is. What are we going to be the best known for in history, like other countries have their thing? And the gold that comes out every single time is our people. It's the first time I've actually come across somebody in the flesh doing that, actually exploiting this incredible opportunity of our amazing people into the world. So the types of skills that employers are looking for currently, what are they? Who are your clients, typical clients that you are outsourcing all these skills to? And are you finding enough of that skill set?
Yes, I think you've really touched the point. Yeah, that is our gold mine right now. I think the young people is our gold mine. And if you see the trajectory of the population growth in Africa, we're going to have over 1.6 billion young people working by 2050. And so what does that mean for us? When you look at the global landscape today, the outsourcing industry is now a $320 billion industry. But when you draw back, India has 51% and Africa has 3%, right? So it does not make sense that this budding population, we can only contribute 3% to this global outsourcing industry. And that said, the only issue has been that people have had this preconception about Africa, the wildlife, and then the charity work that has also painted Africa as a place of need. That has not really helped us a lot. So we are reframing the story to know that now what we have in Africa is actually a gold mine, and this is what we can contribute to the world. So we reverse engineered this and say, we're not going to start where India is right now. However much, it's getting expensive over there. Philippines is getting expensive. And the next place people are going to be starting to look at is Africa. So for us to help us enter this industry very easily, we didn't start with the normal things and stuff like that. We started, what are people looking for right now that we can do well and reposition? So this includes virtual assistants. This includes Amazon Web Services, data analytics. We have a lot of podcast editors. Everyone in America is doing these podcasts. We have sales calls agents. These are people who are booking appointments for people in America, just appointment setters. We have graphic designers, web developers, social media managers. These are things that are no-brainer that people are looking for, and we can just train them today. And within just after a few months of training, kids can actually start to get work. And so when I look at the trainings, we graduated over 900 young people last year, and over 80% of them right now are in active work. And so that's going to help Africa actually start, you know, go up the ladder of becoming a global powerhouse that we all wanted to see, to be.
It makes complete sense that as business owners, we outsource all of our skills development to ERA 92. And I'm talking from a painful own experience. I took on interns that didn't go through a wonderful system and a model like yours that you've unpacked that kind of comes full circle, deals with mindset, deals with the skills and the accountability structures and puts them back into church and the rest of it. And I took on interns into my business over the years on many occasions, and I found it to be a huge risk. And there was one particular intern that I hired at the end of their year of internship, took them on permanently. And this particular intern, I was overseas traveling to see customers. We exported a lot. And we discovered he'd made a mistake on the batch labels going onto product and had accidentally created the batch label or the expiry date the same day as the manufacturing date, which meant all of the stock had expired on label, but not expired in reality. So I said to him, that's no problem. This is how we're going to resolve the problem. Please alert the client, the goods had shipped. This was Iceland Air we were talking about, a major airline. I said, and alert them to the fact that the batch label has a problem on it and that we will rectify and resend the stock. A few days later, something niggled in me. I thought, why have I not heard back from him? I haven't been copied on the email. And it turns out he said, no, he's made his own executive decision about the matter, not to alert the client, because there's a chance that some of them had the correct batch label on. Anyway, it sent me into a panic, because to lose one of our major global clients was a real problem. We did rectify it in the end, but it caused me great stress. How do you mitigate the risk that now comes with people and young people and interns and skills in businesses? How do we as business owners mitigate that risk of empowering and taking on young people and giving them opportunities and the ability to make decisions and use their own creativity within our organizations, but still protect the business?
Yeah, I think it will go down to systems, processes, and training. And I'll tap into that. But you mentioned something that is in our about us as ERA 92. When we started out, we say we are changing stories for young people because we see them differently, right? NGOs see young people as young people with needs. You know, these young people are needy, to help them and stuff like that. Governments see young people as a risk, as a burden, you know, because they were like, you know, they're coming to riot. You know, Africa, we've seen that, you know, in South Africa, we've seen that, like, these young people are just a risk to the government, that they're a threat to the government. And then also business owners today see young people as a burden, you know, they're, you know, expensive to run, they're gonna be training and stuff like that. And so we wanted to make sure people actually overcome this preconceived ideology about these young people and to see how to change how we see them. So first, we see them as valuable employees, ambitious entrepreneurs, and worthy wild clients. Because at the end of the day, if these young people enter into the working ecosystem, they're the next middle class for African continent. And so we have to definitely rewire how we see these young people. So the risk that how to mitigate a risk on these young people is definitely, first of all, you have to give them the freedom in the first place with controlled systems and processes. Because I've seen places where you limit what these young people could do, and then you're already fearful of what the young people can do, and then you have to protect them so much. So we have to figure out areas that are more or less risk to damage the business and give them ultimate freedom to create in the spaces. Because the beauty is they are more creative than us. They are more smarter than us. And if we absorb and sit on that creativity, it's not going to help our businesses. On the other side, we put strong approval systems and quality control systems in place to make sure our clients in America are not disappointed. And so we do this. We have feedback calls with the clients. I had two of them yesterday on how do we improve our system. And then the last part is training. We carry out trainings every single time. You know, the fact that we have built Era 90 to 120 people, and we're only two people above 30 years. It's me and some other guy. All the other kids are 20, 21, 23. And I think I give it back to the training program. It's really, it changes their mindset. It gives them accountability and responsibility, but also gives them real life skills to contribute to the society.
Wonderful advice, Emmanuel. Wonderful advice. Thank you so much. From what I've gathered in how you build your business, it seems like there's a very nice synergy between faith-based risk-taking and sound business practice and wisdom. I learned in business, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, systems and processes are all in place. So often startup entrepreneurs, we just want to take these giant leaps. We hear from God, perhaps quite clearly, get our confirmations. We want to run and fly. And, you know, there is the flip side that business does require sound business practice. So how do you manage that balance?
Yeah, that's true. But the first thing is leading with Jesus and also the Holy Spirit and trusting that I'm not doing things by my own understanding. And that means, as Era 92, we have a culture to actually present things to God before we do them, right? But to just bring it into the real world context, and we have to also operate as business people and build strategies on how we can make our business stay strong. So in the last year, we had most of our 70%, 80% of our revenue coming from the US and the UK. And we saw that it was good at the first time, but also we thought that it could be a risk towards our business. And we thought that, okay, what do we need to do? So we prayed and asked God about what we really need to do. And so we had to actually change our portfolio to make sure that we have really solid revenue coming out on the continent too, so that we are not dependent on the American side. And, you know, COVID can come back again. Things can happen in this world, you know. So diversification has been a key thing for us. But there's another scenario where we wanted to take this program to other communities. But we ran into an issue that in 2020, when COVID hit, we took our programs online. We realized that the people who now access our programs are kids who are living in flats. They had laptops in their homes. And the people that you really wanted to reach out to did not have even a phone in their home. So we came up with this model of turning shipping containers into digital classrooms. And so that we can put them, put computers in it, that we put internet in it, and then put it into the middle of the slum. So a scenario here we can paint: if I was a normal business guy that I was selling graphic designing to international clients, what I would have done is that, you know what, let me hire people wherever they are and make my business grow easily. We had to take a step back and lose some clients and say, we have to wait until we have the people we need to support. And so that was 2021, and we started these digital classrooms in two shipping containers, and we've placed five of them in five districts across Uganda. But it has brought the opportunities that we needed with the right people. And so when God calls you out to serve a certain group of people, you have to do anything to reach out to those people. And that would be sometimes doesn't make sense in a business sense, because why would you go back in those communities? Just go and hire people in Kenya and do your business. But if you have a calling that God has called you to, you have to leave so much on the table to reach those ends.
Great. Emmanuel, you went into a very risky business, which was investing in entrepreneurs through micro loans, Now, that sounds very risky to me. Can you please unpack that, how that's worked, how that risk has paid off? Has it paid off?
Yes, it has paid off. And we just paid our dividends to our investors just in the first quarter. And
congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. I think that really ties into the risk, man. Microfinances are risky, and that's why the people who make money out of them are actually ripping off people. And that's the true, honest thing about microfinances in Africa. They are actually keeping people in poverty. So when we wanted, when we did our survey in 2021, 2022, we did a survey called Where Are They Now? And this was to help us figure out where the kids who came through our programs, where are they, what are they doing? And we got a big shock that so many kids, when they graduated the program, they didn't have a computer. They didn't have internet. And I was like, okay, why would we spend, you know, over 1,000 per student, 500 per student every year to get them to our program all our time just to make them graduate and do nothing? And so as our model, to have a complete holistic model, we had to do something about it. And that led us to dig into a microfinance bank. And when we looked at the rates, I was like, okay, if you right now loan out a computer for 1,000 and you're charging, this kid is going to take it for 2 years and you're charging them a normal interest rate of 23% in Uganda, that is 46%. How is this kid going to get out of poverty? When are they going to pay off this computer? And so we came up with a hybrid model. And so we sacrificed 40% of our portfolio to be interest, low interest loans. Like this is 1 to 2.5% for these young people. But you couldn't run a model based on the interest, on that interest rate. You can't actually turn out a profit. And we realized that, okay, yeah, they're in Uganda. There are people who are actually willing to take on these loans. And they have their businesses going. They have their collateral. Why don't we run a hybrid model where we can serve all these clients who can afford the normal interest rates? And so we did that. And so 40% was for young people who come through our programs. And we used that to build credit for them. So we built our own credit system where young people open up a bank account when they join the program. They start saving all the small little money they make. We do a background search on them. Their character contributes to their credit score. And as they graduate, now they qualify for our interest, a low interest loan, and they get the asset they need. And then on the other side, we're actually selling loans to people who actually can afford it, school fees loans, and people who are investing capital in their business. Right now, we have over $900,000 worth of a loan portfolio, and we've given out over 1,700 loans to people, 700 loans of those people coming through our programs. And what this has made is that it has helped these young people who was at the verge of falling back into their traps of poverty to actually now become entrepreneurs. And that led us to start our portfolio C of companies that we invest into these young people. Remember, if a kid is coming from the slums, they're not going to have credit worth. It's very hard for them to get a loan from the bank. And that means that category of people is likely to stay in poverty for the rest of their lives. And this program has leveled that ground for them, that if you come through our programs, it's likely that you will get the asset you need, and it's likely we can support you to become an entrepreneur. And so 700 of those young people have doubled their income or tripled their income by the time they get the asset. And so that has been life-changing, and I think it goes back to that risk that you have to take on these people that you, if God has called you to serve.
Everything seems really successful. Like every risk you've taken, everything you've done, God's hand has been on it. It's produced results. It's produced fruit. Have there been any risks that you've taken that have not panned out as you anticipated?
Portfolio C, it's all these kind of things. Us giving, when we are running like this Christian social businesses, it's easy for us to have this Christ-like heart, you know? This guy, I love him so much. Let me invest money in him. So this guy came through a program, and he was a kid that knew how to fix any computer, and it was fixing computers that I have. And so because I knew it and I liked it so much, this was our very first investment. And this guy said, Trinity, what if we start another social enterprise where we get all these broken computers, fix them out, and then sell them? And as we sell, every 10 computers we sell, we give 2 to a young person. And that idea was brilliant. I was like, let's do this. You know how to fix computers. You know how we can start the shop. So we started a company called One Click Computers. We invested $20,000. And because we didn't put all the measures in place, right? As you start a business, I was just excited so much. And so that was one lesson. It failed. We were able to get the money out. We brought in a shipment, sold it, brought another one, but the kid wasn't well trained and he got excited. And so I realized that whatever business we do, we have to make sure we have the people to lead it, the person to lead it, the systems and the procedures, and then the capital comes last. So we started with the capital, which had the business. So it didn't start as a natural business that we started because we were excited about it. But that failed, but it was so many lessons out of it. And that led to, you know, the two new businesses we invested in have been successful. Huma Furniture is one of the fastest growing furniture businesses here in Uganda right now. So it's a good one.
Wonderful to hear. And congratulations on mitigating some of that risk or getting some of your money back out. I think that's very resourceful of you. Most of us entrepreneurs only wish we could get half back of what we've lost through all those mistakes and failures and hitting our heads against brick walls. Do you think your appetite for risk and all the risk you took and the leaps of faith would have been different if you'd had a family, for example, at that stage, if you'd had a wife and children to consider? Do you think you might have taken the career path, or do you think you may have, hindsight, but do you think you might have made different decisions?
Yes. That's a good one. I would be honest with you guys that whenever you grow and build successful, you know, things, it's easy that success a little bit to get to your head. So I hadn't bought a house, I hadn't bought a car until 2023, after running Era 92. But I got a few friends that say, man, Trinity, now it's time for you to also enjoy your stuff and stuff like that. And I realized that so many things that we get in our lives actually kill our risk appetite. You know, when I got comfortable, I got my car and I was planning to get a house and stuff like that. All these things become bondages for us to actually trust God more, because like, oh, I don't want to lose this house, I don't want to lose thing. So I got into that phase. And all I needed was the freedom to be able to do things for God. And so in my head, I did what still many people thought I was crazy. I sold off my car and I stayed with the company car and said they would be taking me home. And then I downsized just to get off what I was getting comfortable in my head and just get a simple house. That way, because I was still single and I didn't have a family, so that was easy for me to do. And so in your heart is, God can sense, God can see your heart. Are you trying to enrich yourself or enrich the kingdom? It's really straightforward. I've run a very, very minimal life, and that has made me happy in life, and I don't need anything, and I'm doing it all for the kingdom.
It seems a theme through your interview is that the kingdom way is counterintuitive. And I love that. The world says accumulate, accumulate. God's way says you don't need any of it. I will provide what you need when you need it. Very inspiring. Emmanuel, it has been such a joy and privilege and inspiration and pleasure chatting to you today. You are a story changer. And I think our motto for today's podcast is, I sacrifice so you can win. It's all about serving others. Thank you, Emmanuel.
That's powerful. Thank you for having me. This has been a great unpack of my journey. I've never done something in this space, so it's a blessing. Thank you guys for putting me on this platform.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.